let's dive back into our study. It's called The Pattern for Worship. This is a study that's been several weeks ongoing now on the Old Testament tabernacle in the wilderness. And we started this month looking at the furnishings of the tabernacle. We were really blessed by Innovation Church in Pennsylvania, who had some of these replicas made, and they let us borrow them for a couple of months, which was really kind of them. And so we started 2 weeks ago with the brazen altar. You might remember that was kind of set up in the middle of the room. And then last week we looked at the brazen laver. That was that big sort of bowl that was set up here. And today we're going to look at these two guys. So I want to start by just reminding you a quick overview of the tabernacle setup. There were really three sections to the tabernacle. There is the outer court, which is the area inside the fence but outside the tabernacle itself. By the way, these three areas that we're discussing are still the areas that are maintained today when they build a temple. There's an outer court, an inner court, and then a holy of holies. So they still maintain this pattern. In the outer court, there was a brazen altar where sacrifices were offered and a brazen laver where there was ceremonial cleansing and washing every day. Then just inside the veil into the front two-thirds of the tabernacle was the holy place. And inside the holy place, there are three pieces of furniture, large pieces, the golden lampstand, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. And then when you proceeded through the veil, you went into the Holy of Holies, where there was the Ark of the Covenant with the mercy seat. And so the outer court was a place of judgment and of cleansing. The inner court was a place of communion and of fellowship. And then the inner court, the Holy of Holies, was a place of intimacy with God and redemption. So we see this kind of Trinitarian paradigm set up doctrinally throughout the tabernacle and throughout all of Christian doctrine. The idea that this is one unified place with three separate sections. It's reflective of the Godhead himself. One God, three persons, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. It's reflective of who you are. You're one person, but you're three parts, a body, a soul, and a spirit. So there are all sorts of of symbolism sort of baked into this tabernacle structure. I think probably the most prophetically significant and maybe the highest revelation has to do with the generations of God's people. In the outer court, it was the season of the law. In the outer court, there were sacrifices made every single day, and there were ceremonial washings every day, day and night, night and day, every single day without fail. Because as the New Testament says, it was impossible for the bloods of bulls and goats to purify from sin. You could get forgiveness for a sin, but then when you sin again, you've got the same problem all over again. So the sacrifices were offered perpetually, continually, because though you were getting your sins forgiven, there was nothing about that process that changed you on the inside. You continued sinning and wanting to sin. So that was the age of the law. It was just perpetual cleansing, sacrifice, sinning, forgiving, cleansing, sacrifice over and over and over. The inner court, the holy place, represents the age that we're in. That's the age of grace, where we have communion and fellowship and illumination and proximity to the Lord. That's the age that we're in. And then the Holy of Holies represents an age that is yet to come, when we will have intimate, uninterrupted fellowship with the Lord face to face. And so that symbolism becomes really significant to us as we dig in to this today. Now, I've got a ton of material, and some of it's just, you know, strictly informational, so I just want to rifle through this. I want to start by telling you how the tabernacle itself was physically constructed, because it really was a pretty incredible feat of engineering. The primary principle element of construction were these large wooden planks or beams. They were 27 inches wide, so maybe like that, 18 inches thick, 15 feet tall. We're not sure actually how these beams were constructed because there were no trees that grew in the Middle East of a dimension that you could get this out of holy. But anyway, there were 45 of these beams constructed out of acacia wood and overlaid all around with gold. So you can just imagine what those would have weighed. By the way, each of the elements of the tabernacle were the assignment of a particular family in Israel. So it may well be that the cooks were responsible for carrying these pieces. So what would happen is these giant beams were set into silver bases. The bases or pedestals were made out of silver. And the Old Testament word probably that's most frequently most frequent rendering is sockets. They were giant bases that would fit these in them. They were each made of one talent of silver. A talent would have been about 100 pounds. So the base weighed 100 pounds, and there were 45 of them around the perimeter that outlined the tabernacle. So just the foundation of the tent would have been approaching 5 tons of metal. And then you would put the boards inside of that. So you can imagine this was not a pup tent. This was not a camping tent. This was something far more substantial. And then once the boards were all set in the sockets, they would put coverings over top of the tabernacle. In the holy place, we get into compound symbolism. Symbols that come together to paint a larger picture. So in the construction of the tabernacle, we have these planks of wood representing humanity, overlaid with gold, which represents divinity. Wood and gold together are representative of Jesus. Very good. You guys have really been paying attention. I'm proud of you. So you have these beams that represent Jesus Christ, and they are set in sockets of silver, and silver represents redemption. Now, to understand the prophetic significance of this, we have to ask the question today, who are the redeemed? That's right, it's Joe Paul. Joe is the one. It's any believer, any Christ follower, you are the redeemed. So in the tabernacle, bearing in mind now, the tabernacle was the place where God's foot touched the earth. It's the one place, the geographical spot in all the world where you could come and encounter God. And it happened by virtue of these gold-plated panels set in these silver bases. And today, the way that God's foot touches the earth is by taking his son and placing it in the heart of redeemed people. This whole structure is representative of the church. Couldn't Jesus just come himself and make himself known? Certainly. He just has chosen to not do it that way. He's chosen rather to do it in you. He has chosen to set his spirit in your heart, and now you are the place, and this is, we've been talking about this from the very beginning. Now as a priest, your job is to arrange meetings between people and God. You are the place, literally, where that meeting takes place. So the presence of God will be hosted in the earth through his people, through his church. Then once the walls were standing, there were a series of four massive coverings that were pulled over top. Now, there are a lot of things, even with as much detail as we have, there are a lot of things we don't know about the tabernacle or how it was put up. This is one of the great mysteries right here, exactly how they pulled this off. Each of these coverings would have been really massive, really heavy. How you would get these up 15 feet to begin to drape them, I don't know. There certainly would have been a process, but there were four of them. The first one was white linen with red, blue, and purple angels embroidered on the inside. And so they would, after this wall structure was in place, they would pull this covering over top, and they would stretch it from both sides and then pin it in the ground. Then the second covering would go on top, and the second covering was a layer of black goat's hair. So these would have been the hides of hundreds, perhaps thousands of goats, dyed black and pulled over top then of the first covering. This black covering would be representative of the sins of the people. Then the third covering were ram skins dyed red, obviously representing the blood that covers the sins of the people. It was pulled over top. And then the very outer layer is really an enigma for us. It's a Hebrew word we don't see anywhere else in the Old Testament or in the world. It means some kind, we believe, of marine animal. But we don't know exactly what it is. If you read 10 different translations, you'll get four or five different renderings. Here are some of them. Some will say badger skin. Some will say porpoise skin, though they were nowhere near the Mediterranean. But God can do anything, so maybe they were porpoises. Probably the most accurate translation of the Hebrew word is sea cow. We don't know what that is in today's parlance. That would be a manatee. But whatever it was weatherproof because this was the outer layer, so it would have shed water and it would have protected the entire the entire structure from weather. When you walked in, the holy place was 15 feet tall, really tall ceilings, 30 feet long, 15 feet wide. And it would have been a fascinating thing from a sensory standpoint to step into the holy place. First of all, the ground would just be dirt. When you looked around, what you would see are solid gold walls 15 feet around. Directly above you, you would see the white linen curtain with the angels embroidered in it. The only light in the room would have been coming from the golden candlestick reflecting off all the gold in the room. So it would have been a really beautiful visual sight. You would have, bearing in mind that just on the other side of the veil, there were nonstop sacrifices going on. And so the sound of livestock and all that's associated with the daily sacrifices. And then beyond that, 4 or 5 million people. So crowds, you know, lots of crowd noise. But when you stepped in the holy place, you had thick layers of insulation. You had these boards all the way around, multiple layers over top of you. So it would have been, I don't know how many of you have ever been in a recording studio, but when you step into a real recording studio, you suddenly become aware of the absence of sound. Like the room just absorbs the sound. That's what you would have experienced in there, like suddenly quiet, suddenly cool. Suddenly you come from the blazing Middle East sun into a place of dim lighting. It would have been a dramatic sensory moment. The smell of the room would have been of fresh bread and incense, and there would just be a dramatic difference between the outer court and coming into the holy place. One of the images that stays with me, and you'll just have to forgive me. This is the dramatist in me. The Bible doesn't say this, and I haven't seen it anywhere. But when you came into the holy place, you would be looking directly at the veil that separated you from the Holy of Holies. And it was a veil. It was a curtain that was hung from a rod, a giant curtain to be sure, but a curtain that was hung from a rod. It wasn't like a weatherproof sliding door. It was just a curtain. And so beyond that, what you would have seen is the Shekinah glory of God breaking through the top and the sides. I mean, can you imagine standing in that room and seeing the evidence of the presence of God, the literal presence of Yahweh seated on the mercy seat, and he's right there. He is observing as you tend the lampstand, as you tend the bread. It's literally a worship service involving one person and God himself. Really a remarkable moment. The golden lampstand. Let's look at Exodus chapter 25. When you set up the tabernacle, the entrance was always facing east. And so when you came into the holy place, the golden candlestick was always to the left or the south, and the table of showbread. So if we're oriented this way, this would be the east. That would be where the candlestick would be. This would be where the table of showbread would be. And here's what the Bible said about building this implement. Make the lampstand out of pure gold. Hammer out its base and shaft, and make its flower-like cups, buds, and blossoms of one piece with them. 6 branches are to extend from the sides of the lampstand, 3 on one side, 3 on the other. 3 cups shaped like almond flowers with buds and blossoms are to be on one branch, 3 on the next branch, and the same for all 6 branches extending from the lampstand. And on the lampstand, there are to be 4 cups shaped like almond flowers with buds and blossoms. 1 bud shall be under the first pair of branches extending from the lampstand, a second bud under the second pair, and a third bud under the third pair, 6 branches in all. The buds and the branches shall be of one piece with the lampstand hammered out of pure gold. Then make it 7 lamps and set them up on it so that they light the space in front of it. Its wick trimmers and trays are to be of pure gold. A talent of pure gold is to be used for the lampstand and all these accessories. See that you make them according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. So the physical properties, we are given no dimensions on this, like the laver, no specifications on this. Every other piece we're given very precise dimensions and we're reminded to build it exactly to scale. With the laver and with the lampstand, apparently the artisans were given a lot of liberty on how big to make it and some creative license. It was to be made of pure gold, and it was to be one piece, not multiple pieces that were sort of joined together. It was not a candlestick, though sometimes you'll hear people call it the golden candlestick. There was no wax involved. It was a lampstand, and so each of these buds held olive oil, and then wicks were fixed, and it would drink up the oil, and it would burn the wick as the lamp burned. And so once it was lit, it never went out. It was never allowed to go out. It burned continuously day and night. The wicks, by the way, were the product of discarded priests' tunics. So when a priest would wear out his tunic or it would get stained or whatever, they would trim it up so that it was, those garments were not allowed to be used for anything else. They weren't allowed to be thrown away. They had to be burned, and they were burned in the form of wicks in this golden candlestick. Made of solid gold, about 1 talent, it would have weighed about 100 pounds. This is probably, in general scale, about the size it would have been. By the way, if you're at all like me, I was just a little curious about this. So Gold closed at just over $2,000 an ounce on Friday. So if anybody's doing the math, that would make this piece worth somewhere just north of $3.2 million in modern-day currency. So it was a really valuable. All this furniture would have been really, really valuable. And ultimately, when the temple was overrun, it was overrun for the gold, which is why all this stuff went missing ultimately. There was a daily service at the lampstand, and that involved a priest coming in the morning. They would do a ceremonial washing. They would come to the lampstand, and they would use a wick trimmer, and they would cut off the wick that had burned overnight. Then they would pull more wick out. They would refill all the cups with oil, and then it would be good to burn all day. And then as they approached sundown, another priest would go through a ceremonial washing, would come in, would trim the wicks that had burned during the day, pull more wick out, fill the oil so that it would burn all night long. They never had to light this. It was always lit with fire from the Lord. You guys remember when they first dedicated the tabernacle. We looked at this before, and we'll study it again, but they made the sacrifice. They were told they put the sacrifice on the altar, and the Bible said that fire fell from heaven and consumed the sacrifice and ignited the altar. And from that day till the day they crossed over the Jordan River into the Promised Land, it was their job to maintain the fire. So everything that required fire or heat in the tabernacle came from the fire of heaven. The fire on the altar of incense came from the altar. The fire that ignited this lamp came from the altar. And no other fire was permitted. God called anything else strange fire, and it would result in death. And we proved that at least once. So there was a family whose job it was to maintain the fire. Whenever they transported the tabernacle, they would break it down, and this family were the custodians of holy fire. And they would get fire from the altar, and they would feed it as they traveled. They had to keep it dry. They had to maintain it. And then once the tabernacle had been reestablished, they would light the altar. They would light the candle. And for 40-plus years, all the services of the tabernacle were conducted with the fire that God sent from heaven. Isn't that amazing? And by the way, when it comes to church, we don't have to bring the fire. The Lord does that. But making sure that the wicks are trimmed and that there's plenty of oil, that is your responsibility. I so appreciate Fernanda and team serving this morning, but it is no worship leader's responsibility to convince you to worship. This is not a scenario where the church is supposed to pay somebody to come up here and try to convince you or seduce you, try to get you in the mood to worship the Lord. I can't tell you how completely exhausted I am as a worship leader. I'm just never, ever going to do that again. That's what it becomes. You know, so often in church, it becomes somebody on stage saying, come on, guys, please, please worship the Lord. He really is worthy. What if we do a song you like? What if we, I mean, as though. No, worship is your responsibility. Worship is you're the priest. You're supposed to maintain, it's not your responsibility to bring the fire, but you have to maintain your life and your heart and your disposition such that fire will burn. The symbolic of the significance of the lampstand is profound. It was made of solid gold, which represents divinity, nothing else, just God. We have the light, the fire. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. A light hidden under a bushel doesn't get seen. He said, I am the light. And then the oil, which represents the Holy Spirit. So we have the entire Trinity represented here. Revelation chapter 1 says this. This is John the Revelator speaking, and he said, I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me, and when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like the Son of Man, dressed in a robe, reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest. And the hair on his head was white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like a blazing fire. And his feet were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and his voice was like the sound of rushing waters. And in his right hand, he held seven stars, and coming out of his mouth was a sharp double-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in all of its brilliance. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead. And then he placed his right hand on me, and he said, do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the living one. I was dead, and now look, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades. Write therefore what you have seen, what is now and what will take place later. The mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and of the seven golden lampstands is this. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches. This lampstand, in its beautiful portrayal of the Godhead, is prophetically significant of the church. It was always God's intention that the church would be his mechanism for delivering the message of grace and mercy to the world. That was always the plan. It wasn't a plan B. It wasn't an afterthought. It wasn't because something else broke down and failed. This was always the plan. It's interesting. When you were in the outer court, your source of sunlight was dependent upon astronomy. The sun goes up and it lights the world, and the sun goes down and it gets dark. Daytime and nighttime. If you're a good person, you experience nighttime and daytime. If you're a bad person, you experience daytime and nighttime. It's the same for everybody. You're locked into that cycle. When we are with the Lord in eternity, the Bible has a lot to say about that period of time. And someday soon, I'll teach a series on it. But it's going to be amazing. It's amazing. Here are some things that the Bible says about that time. It says that in eternity, we're going to know one another. It's not like we're some amorphous, angelic, amoebic beings, right? When Jesus came back, they immediately knew who he was, and he knew who they were, and he was in his resurrected body. What I love about that, Evan, is we're going to know each other. I mean, not just to recognize, but we will have intact the recollection of all of our history, and then with it, the knowledge of all of eternity. And I mean, just like if I think no further than the four of us sitting around laughing at the things that broke our hearts. I mean, can you imagine your kids and my kids and our grandkids and worshiping the Lord nonstop? And there will be food. Food. Right? The wedding supper of the Lamb. Bro, pan pizza, extra sauce. You hear what I'm saying? Like, food is one of the great things in life. Like, I love a good meal. And then a good meal with friends and family. It's going to be indescribable. Unbelievable, that season. Well, what the Bible says of that season is there will be no need for the sun because Jesus himself will be the light. His presence will illuminate everything in that season. But for now, in between, there's one source of light. When you're in the holy place, when you're in the age of grace, the only source of light is the church. And if that notion disturbs you, if you look at the state of the church and you think, holy crap, I probably could have found a better... Take two. If you look at the state of the church and you're like, oh, this is the hope of the world? Then first of all, you have swerved into why we started Tapestry. And it's not because any of us think we're smarter than anyone else, but we just thought, well, let's start from scratch. Let's debulk some of this extraneous stuff. Because what it's supposed to be is a source of illumination and encouragement. When you're outside the holy place, it's a barren wilderness. It's a wasteland. There's very little beauty. When it's a raging storm, though, inside the holy place, it's calm. Out in the wilderness, when it's sun-scorched and the heat is baking and it's destructive and you can't breathe, inside the holy place, it's cool with soft light. It's supposed to be a place of illumination and refreshing. That's what it's supposed to be. I know it has not been that for all of you. It hasn't always been that. And I'm really sorry. And I couldn't be more sincere. It breaks my heart. In some ways, you know, up until Tapestry, I feel like I've, Nick's going to feel free to edit this for the online version, but in many ways, I feel like I've spent my life sitting in church staff meetings saying, this is ridiculous. Why are we doing this? What are we doing? We have water. You know, like, and so I am so sorry if you have been, this mentality has taken hold where it's like, it's supposed to be the church taking care of you, protecting you, pouring into you, investing in you. That's what it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be the church trying to see what they can get out of you so they can build their own footprint bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. I know that's what it's become in a lot of places, but that's not what it's supposed to be. But however broken and flawed, it's still his plan A. It's still, he said, it's a lampstand set on a hill. So let's fix it. Let's ask the Holy Spirit to give us insight and wisdom on how we can get this right. Because in this age, the church is the light. Over on the north side, the right is the table of showbread. Exodus 25 describes it this way: make a table out of acacia wood, 2 cubits long, 1 cubit wide, 1.5 cubits high. Overlay it with pure gold and make a gold molding around it. Also make around it a rim of a hand breadth wide and put a gold molding on the rim. Make 4 gold rings for the tables and fasten them to the 4 corners where the 4 legs are. The rings are to be close to the rim to hold the poles used in carrying the table. Make the poles out of acacia wood, overlay them with gold and carry the table with them. And make its plates and dishes out of pure gold, as well as its pitchers and bowls for the pouring out of offerings. Put the bread of the presence on this table to be before me at all times. So the table's 3 feet long, 1.5 feet wide, 2 feet 3 inches tall. its wood overlaid with gold, representative of Christ. It had 12 loaves of bread. Wouldn't be loaves like you think of today. They would be more like cakes, like are represented here. And they represented the 12 tribes of Israel, a cake for each tribe of Israel. It's interesting, we don't know the recipe for this bread. It's a bit of a mystery. But we know that among other things, each cake was to use 7 pounds of flour. So these would have been enormous loaves of bread, and they were changed out every Sabbath, and the bread that was taken out was used to feed the priesthood. In fact, they were commanded to eat it. And then on each stack of bread, a container of incense was set near the bread. So every morning, when the priest tended the lampstand, he would tend the table of showbread, and he would sprinkle the bread with the incense. And then there was a libation offering. We don't know much about this. It just gets referenced. But so there would have been some kind of a container of wine, and it would be poured out in the presence of the Lord every morning, every evening, as part of the priest's service in the tabernacle. The symbolic significance is pretty graphic. You saw in that verse it was called the bread of the presence. It's really an interesting Hebrew terminology. It's the actual translation is bread of the face, which is why some people call it show bread. That's not really a thing. It's just a term that they invented to match this Hebrew word. But it's basically presence. It's bread that you have in the face of the Lord, in the presence of God. And the symbolism is clear. In the midst of the wilderness, in the midst of a hostile territory, this is a place where you can encounter God. In a place that was lacking in provision, this is a place where you can have provision. In a place where you might otherwise be desperate or needy, here was a place where your needs would be met and your desires would be satisfied. And again, this is supposed to be what the church is. A place where you come and you can be cared for and fed. And obviously, as evangelicals, we look here and we see the symbols of communion, the bread and the wine. That wouldn't have been lost on them. They were celebrating the feast of Passover at this point. But the idea of communion is implicit here. Communion with the Lord, communion with one another. And when we say communion, it's baked into the word is union. The idea that you're connected. You're connected to people other than yourself, to a larger community, to a God that's bigger than just you and your interests or you and your needs. We live in a fascinating season right now. In many ways, this feels to me I feel like we're at a fulcrum, kind of like the early to mid-70s, and maybe even more drastically. Here's what I mean. Coming out of the Second World War, the nation experienced this incredible season of unity and prosperity. Unlike anything we'd experienced before, and maybe unlike anything we'll experience again, Boy, the train was headed up. And all through the 50s and early 60s, we were just unaware of the fractures that were developing. Then there were a series of events. The Kennedy assassination in 67 was a big one. I remember my parents, who were not, fans of John Kennedy, talking about what a gut punch it was. Like the whole earth stood still and gasped. shocking, disillusioning. You know, probably the most popular president of the modern age, just gunned down, so young, beautiful wife, young kids, just shocking. And then less than a year later, the most famous civil rights leader of all time, same thing, assassinated. And it was startling. And then Vietnam carries us into the early 70s, and then Watergate. And what happened was there was an entire, this schism developed between younger generations and older generations. And this entire group, this younger group just said, you know what? We don't trust anything to do with authority or our parents' generation. We're tuning out. And they turned to drugs and sex and music. They created their own subculture. And this schism develops nationally that we are still experiencing the effects of today. It was this national cataclysm. Now, I also want to say that the Lord was in the midst of that, because it was that schism that produced the Jesus movement. So I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. I believe God's in the midst of it. But I think we're facing something very similar right now. I think it'll be generations from now before we understand the real impact of COVID and COVID policy. But in addition to just the general dilemma, and if you're getting nervous, don't. I'm not going to get political. But for the first time that we were aware of in a public way, we had this collusion, this collaboration, this open collaboration between the government and major media news outlets, where they got in meetings and said, listen, let's agree on what we're going to say and what we're not going to say. And then there's certain things you're not allowed to say at all, and we won't let you say it on air. And like, it becomes this very, now for the sake of public rhetoric, I will assume everyone had the best motives in the world to save the world. That was the narrative. In order to save the world, we have to agree on the solution. And then later on, it would be a couple years later, when Elon buys Twitter and releases the Twitter files, and we find out that as people were turning away from major media, turning to social media for information, that the federal government was also controlling social media, saying what's allowed to be said and what isn't allowed to be said, you know, and that sort of thing. And then we start to find out that some of the things that everyone had agreed on weren't true, either partially or entirely or whatever. So here's my point. Now it's not divided by generation, but there are whole groups of people that have just concluded you cannot trust anything that you hear from a government agency. They just said a pox on all their houses. I don't trust the CDC. I don't trust the industrial medical complex. I don't trust NASA. I don't trust banks. I've got a bunch of people that work for me that have gone to cash. I don't want you. I want cash. It's this distrust of institutions. I mean, across the board, this is happening. Like, folks have gone full prep mode. They're, you know, growing their own stuff and building their bomb shelters. And I don't know who's right and who's wrong. That's not what I'm saying. But here's the thing. That's happened to the church. People, they sequestered from church. They started watching online. And because churches were siding with government agencies and churches were becoming political, a lot of folks just said, phooey on church. I could just stay home and watch it. And I can see the best preachers in town, and I can, and that's what's happened, this distrust of church as an institution. And churches have played right along with it. It all becomes about the show. But surprise, church was never supposed to be about the show. It was never supposed to be an entertainment venue. But when people disconnect and they watch from a distance, that's all you have is the show. But it's not. It's an organism. It's a living thing. My whole life, I've always been into, well, I like anything to do with the ocean or marine life. And I think my whole adult life, I've maintained a marine aquarium somewhere in my existence, in my office or at my home or in my room or something. And so my very tolerant wife puts up with this 150-gallon marine tank in our home, which is beautiful. Man, marine tanks, they're just the most beautiful things in the world, like the creatures that live there, and it's like constantly evolving and changing, and creepy things come out that you didn't know were there to begin with. It's very much like the church. And every day it's different. And when people come over, it's a great conversation piece because there's so many interesting things, and they ask questions. And one of the questions that always comes up is they say, well, gosh, this must be a lot of work to maintain. And the answer is no. It's really, really not. It's a lot of work to get it started. But once it establishes itself, it's really easy because it's an ecosystem. It feeds itself. So we do a water change and we clean it, but we don't add any chemicals. It's not like fresh water where you have to continually test and add chemicals because you're creating a fake environment that isn't real. It's right. So when you have fake environments that aren't real, you have to continually, how are we doing? Let's check the polls. Let's check the streaming numbers. We've got to add a little of this, add a little of that. But an ecosystem sustains itself. Now, there are people who like the beauty of an aquarium, and do we have the screensaver over there? Yeah. They have screensavers, or they'll put them on their TVs, and that's pretty, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. And I'm just here to tell you, watching a service is nothing like being part of a church. They're just not even in the same category of thing. Like, I love watching church services. I find it really educational and sometimes inspirational. But I'm not in a living environment where things are investing in me and things are required of me, being drawn out of me to invest in other people, where I'm being forced to grow. And in my aquarium, everything grows and evolves and changes, or it dies. And then it helps other things grow and evolve and change. It is an ongoing living organism. And the church is an ongoing living organism. Flawed? Yes, for sure. Populated with people? Yes. And do people suck? Yes. Yes, they do. We curated a lot of folks to get the non-suckiest ones we could find, but other churches keep sending us their sucky. Flag on the play. A church is a living thing. It's a spiritual family. And I say that so cautiously because some of you have been hurt by your spiritual family. And I wish I had words to heal that. I wish I could, in good conscience, guarantee you that wouldn't happen here. I can't, and I'm not called to that. What I do want to tell you, though, is that to cut yourself off, you're like the guy in the hospital pulling the stuff out of his arms. It's not going to go well. I understand why you want to. I get it. But really, this is the Lord's source of light and spiritual nutrition for the world. Can you walk with the Lord without the church? Yes, you can. Will you? No. Not likely. I've seen everybody test this theory, including the guy who mentored me. Most spiritual guy I ever knew. And he got exasperated with the church and walked away. And when he passed away, he was at his lowest spiritual point in his life. Here's the thing. God establishes authority structures and then he works through them. He's just a God of order. So the national government, the federal government, the upcoming presidential race, I can't even believe it. It's like a comedy, right? We're all being punked. And yet, whatever happens, whoever wins, that's God's established authority. And so I will respect them and I will honor them with my mouth and I will trust God to bless me through them. I work a lot with the city government and I know a lot of those folks. And I really have to trust the Lord. I really trust him. Maybe you work for a boss who's a total bozo and doesn't know what they're doing. Guess what? God's going to work through that authority structure. He's a God of authority. And as broken and flawed as the church is, that's his spiritual authority in the earth. Here's what the Bible says. God sets the lonely in families, and he leads the prisoners out with singing. But the rebellious, they will live in a sun-scorched land. Psalm 68:6. Can you survive on your own in a sun-scorched land? In theory, it's possible. It's a really tough way to do it, though. It's a really tough way to do it. I'm going to ask the worship team to get in place. I want to read you guys something. Many years ago, I was scheduled to go to a conference. And I can't remember what the scenario was, but anyway, I couldn't go. And so instead I got back in the day, they would send you the conference CDs, you know, a little book and you open it up, it's got CDs in it. Anyone? No? No. Okay. Anyway, this guy named Bill Britton was supposed to speak and he got up and instead of speaking, he said, during worship, the Lord gave me a vision. A prophetic vision, and I want to share it with you. And he shared it and sat down. Now, it's a bit lengthy. I want to read it to you in closing, and then I'm going to ask Andy to sing for us, and that'll be the service. Here's what it says. He got up, he said, on a dirt road in the middle of a wide field stood a beautiful carriage. Something on the order of a stagecoach, but all edged in gold, with beautiful carvings all around. It was pulled by six large chestnut horses, two in the lead, two in the middle, and two in the rear. But they weren't moving. They weren't pulling the carriage, and I wondered why. And then I saw the driver underneath the carriage on the ground on his back, just behind the last two horses' heels, working on something between the front two wheels on the carriage. And I thought, my, he's in a dangerous place. For if one of those horses kicked or stepped back, they would kill him. Or if they decided to go forward or got frightened somehow, they would pull the carriage right over him. But he didn't seem afraid, for he knew that the horses were disciplined and would not move until he told them to move. The horses were not stamping their feet or acting restless. And though there were bells on their feet, the bells were not tinkling. And though there were pom-poms on the harness over their heads, the pom-poms weren't moving. They were simply standing still and quiet, waiting for the voice of the master. And as I watched the harnessed horses, I looked and I saw two young colts coming out of the open field. And they approached the carriage and they seemed to say to the horses, come and play with us. We have many fine games and we will race with you. Come catch us. And with that, the colts kicked up their heels and they flicked their tails and they raced across the open field. But when they looked back, they saw the horses were not following. They were puzzled. They knew nothing of the harnesses and could not understand why the horses didn't want to play. So they called to them. Why do you not race with us? Are you tired? Are you weak? Do you not have the strength to run? You're just much too solemn. You need more joy in your life. But the horses answered not a word, nor did they stamp their feet or toss their heads. They stood quiet and still, waiting on the voice of their master. Then again, the colts called to them, "Why do you stand in the hot sun? Come over here in the shade in this nice tree. See how green the grass is? You must be hungry. Come and feed with us. It's so green and so good. You look thirsty. Come drink of our many streams of cool, clear water." But the horses answered not a word, but stood waiting for the command to go forward with the king. And then the scene changed. And I saw lariat nooses fall around the necks of the two colts, and they were led off to the master's corral for training and discipline. How sad they were as the lovely green fields disappeared and they were put into the confinement of the corral with its brown dirt and its high fence. The colts ran from fence to fence seeking freedom, but found that they were confined in this place of training. And when the trainer began to work with them with his whip and his bridle, what a death to those who had all their lives been accustomed to such freedom. They couldn't understand the reason for this torture, this terrible discipline. What crime had they committed to deserve this? Little did they know of the responsibility that was to be theirs when they had submitted to the discipline, learned to perfectly obey the master and finish their training. All they knew was that this process was the most horrible thing they had ever known. One of the colts rebelled. He couldn't take the training, and he said, "This is not for me. I like my freedom, my green hills, my flowing streams of fresh water. I will not take any more of this confinement, this terrible training." So he found a way out. He jumped a fence and ran happily back to the meadows of grass. I was astonished that the master let him go, didn't run after him. But he devoted his attention to the remaining colt. This colt, though he had the same opportunity to escape, decided to submit his will and learn the ways of the master. The training got harder than ever, but he was rapidly learning more and more how to obey the slightest wish of the master and to respond even to the quietness of his voice. And I saw that had there been no training, no testing, there would neither have been submission or rebellion from either of the colts. For in the field, they did not have the choice to rebel or submit. They were sinless in their innocence. But when brought to this place of testing and training and discipline, then was made manifest the obedience of one and the rebellion of another. And though it seemed safer not to come to this place of discipline because of the risk of being found rebellious, I also saw that without this place of discipline, there could be no sharing of glory. And no sonship. Finally, the training was over. Was he now rewarded with his freedom and sent back to the fields? No. A greater confinement than ever took place as a harness was dropped over his shoulders, and now he found there was not even the freedom to run around the small corral, for in his harness, he could only move where and when the master said. And unless the master spoke, he stood absolutely still. And the scene changed. And I saw the other colt standing on the side of the hill, nibbling at some grass. And across the fields, down the road, came the king's carriage, drawn by six chestnut horses. And with amazement, he saw that in the lead on the right side was his brother colt, now made strong and mature on the good corn at the master's stable. And he saw lovely pom-poms shaking in the wind. And he noticed the glittering gold-bordered harness around his brother. He heard the beautiful tinkling of bells on his feet, and envy came into his heart. And he complained to himself, "Why is my brother been honored and I neglected? They've not put bells on my feet. or pom-poms on my head. The master has not given me the wonderful responsibility of pulling his carriage. He's not put me in a gold harness. Why have they chosen my brother instead of me? And the Spirit of God sent the answer back as I watched, because one submitted to the will and discipline of the master and one rebelled. Thus, one has been chosen and one has been set aside. And then, this is the last part. I saw a great drought sweep across the country. And the green grass became dead, dry, brown, and brittle. And the little streams of water dried up. They stopped flowing. There was only a small muddy puddle here and there. I saw the little colt. I was amazed that he never seemed to grow or mature. And he ran here and there across the fields looking for fresh streams and green pastures, but finding none. Still he ran, seemingly in circles, always looking for something to feed his famished spirit. But there was a famine in the land, and the green rich pastures and flowing streams of yesterday were not to be had. And one day the colt stood on the hillside on weak and wobbly legs, wondering where to go to find food and how to get the strength to go. It seemed like there was no use, for good food and flowing streams were a thing of the past, and all the efforts to find more only taxed his waning strength. And then, suddenly, he saw the king's carriage coming down the road, pulled by six great chestnut horses. And he saw his brother, fat and strong, with much grooming and beautiful, muscles rippling and sleek. And his heart was amazed and perplexed. And he cried out, "Brother, where do you find food in this famine? How do you say strong and fat? I have run everywhere searching for food and I find none. Where in your awful confinement can you find food in this time? I must know." And the answer came back from a voice filled with victory and praise. "In my master's house, there is a secret place. In the confining limitations of his stables, and there he feeds me with his own hand. And his granaries never run empty, and his wells never run dry." And with this, the Lord made me know that in the day when people are weak and famished in their spirits, in the time of spiritual famine, that those have lost their own wills, have come to a secret place of the Most High and to utter confinement in his perfect will, they will have plenty of the corn of heaven and a never-ending flow of fresh streams of revelation by his Spirit. God, in talking to Moses, said, "There's a place near me. And if you'll come, I'll cover you with my hand and you'll see my glory pass by." God wasn't content to just save you. He wanted to set you in a family where there could be people who would know you and care for you and feed you and pray for you, and you could do the same for them, united by a single thing, the person of Jesus Christ. Flawed, broken, fractured, still his bride. I didn't know it was possible to love anyone the way I love my wife. I know she's not perfect, but don't you dare say a thing about it. That's my wife.